Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
Was that okay?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, cool.
It's the 24th of May, 2019. I'm Simon Copland.
And I'm Benjamin Riley.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode, we talk our way through questions on a theme. And this week, we're talking about Game of Thrones and critiques of pop culture.
But first, we wanted to get a couple of little admin things out of the way. We've had a little bit of feedback recently about the fact that we now have ads on the podcast. And we realized that it's not something that we've talked about at all. It just kind of happened and we didn't say anything. So it's worth addressing why that's happened and, I don't know, justifying it, I guess. So the reason we have ads is that we've joined Lip Media, a podcast network, and that was kind of part of the deal there. It generates a small amount of revenue for us as well, which is, I mean, essentially the very straightforward justification for us doing it. This is something that Simon and I do on our own time. It's very time-consuming, and as much as we enjoy doing it, we need some financial incentive to continue doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, it costs money and time to do it, so some help is useful and required.
Yeah, and I think despite the fact that we are a podcast that frequently critiques, well, certainly capitalism broadly, but the ways that various businesses operate and that sort of stuff, it's important to say that whilst all of that is true, we also obviously live in a society where we need money to live. And I think both Simon and I feel very strongly about the fact that having some compensation for what we're doing is important, and ads a way of doing that.
And I guess maybe we could say as well is that this is also why we set up the Patreon, as a way to help provide some support for the podcast. And, you know, if I guess the Patreon gets bigger and better, it sort of helps us. We won't need the ads as much. So, you know, one way to support the podcast is to subscribe to the Patreon, and that can help us in this way as well. And we can sort of, I think we'd both prefer to be getting some of that money from subscribers and supporters and our community rather than from ads. But at this point in time, this is where we're at.
Also, kind of an odd thing perhaps to talk about, given that we're at episode, I don't know, 60-something or 50-something or wherever we're at, 58. We stopped putting numbers on them recently, so I've lost track.
It's right in the script there, Ben, that we're looking at.
Oh, really? We have got a lot of new listeners recently, thanks in large part to having joined Lit Media, and thought it would be good to just talk about what the podcast is broadly, what people should expect from it, and what we're trying to do with it. I worry sometimes that with a name as general as Queers, although I do still really like the name of our podcast, people might jump on and think that we are claiming to be representative of queer culture somehow or something like that. And it's just really not what we're trying to do at all. I think if I were to sum up what the podcast is about and what I think we're trying to achieve with it, it's a critical take on queer politics and culture. So Simon and I come at it from, I think, quite a hopefully a self-critical lens, certainly, but a we're trying to question our own positions on things, question other kind of widely held positions on things, and really try to come at each topic from the position of not necessarily having really firm views and trying to feel out what our views might be.
Yeah, this is like a really, it's a discussion podcast, and this is why we focus on one theme every fortnight, as it gives us a space to really go into something in depth, and to do so often coming out with more questions than we have answers. We're not here to provide definitive answers on political topics or cultural topics. We sort of go in with questions and see where we end up, and quite frequently end up in places that neither of us would have expected by the end of a conversation.
Which to me is the fun of doing the podcast, and certainly embodies of a type of critique that I really like, which is one that's a bit, hopefully a bit vulnerable, a bit open to change, and is really about dialogue and relentless, sometimes overly relentless self-examination, rather than espousing really deeply held views and hanging on to those. So that is, I think, something that makes us quite different from a lot of queer-themed podcasts out there, and it's something that I'm happy that we're doing.
Me too.
So keep listening if you've jumped on board in the last month or so. We're very glad to have all these new folk, and hope you're enjoying what we're doing. Game of Thrones ended its final season this week, and it has been a controversial one. The last season of the show has been criticised heavily for its writing, character development, and more, with one strand of this focus being on its treatment of female characters.
I have been watching Game of Thrones with a group of friends every week this season. In fact, it's a group of friends in which we had previously watched all of the previous seasons in the lead up to the last season.
Oh my goodness.
And I have to admit that I am slightly obsessed with the show and really enjoyed it. And with my friends, I've been thinking a lot about the criticisms of this season, and we've all found ourselves a little frustrated by them, I have to admit. But at the same time, I found them interesting too, particularly the level of investment people have placed into the characters and the perceived failings of the storytelling. So to continue my obsession today, I've pushed Ben into talking about the season with a particular view to examine what the critiques of the show say about modern day responses to pop culture.
So while Game of Thrones is a starting point here, today we want to talk about critiques of pop culture more generally. In particular, we want to talk about what responsibility pop culture franchises like Game of Thrones have to their audiences, and in turn, whether pop culture has a responsibility to depict certain views of the world. So Simon, given you're the Game of Thrones obsessed one here, you said you found yourself frustrated at the criticisms of this season. Why?
So I think we should start with a little warning that this episode is dark and full of this episode is probably going to be dark and full of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the last season of Game of Thrones,
that's a Game of Thrones reference.
It is a Game of Thrones reference.
I'm up with pop culture.
You have seen the last season, haven't you, Ben?
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, be aware that you might want to go and finish it off before we get through this discussion. But I figure everybody, you know, if you've been on the internet between now and, you know, when it came out on Monday, you have already been spoiled. So really, there's you know, we're not diving into too dark territory here.
So many memes.
Yes, yeah, so many memes, so much discussion, so many news headlines. The Guardian even had a live blog of the last episode, which is something that I find fascinating about Game of Thrones, is about how much of a phenomenon it was, and it remains to be. I've never seen, in my lifetime at least, a pop cultural phenomenon that is so large and that has sort of, you know, taken up so much energy and investment from people. And it's one of the things I find really interesting about it. But I think I could split the critiques of the show into two, at least two dominant themes that I've seen around the show. And the first one I totally agree with in many ways. And that was that the last season, and probably that season 7 as well, was in many ways too rushed. But I think the second one, the second sort of strand of critiques I found really interesting was this kind of a right that viewers felt that they had, that the Game of Thrones depicted a world that they wanted to see. And I think this played out as well really strongly with a lot of critiques of how the female characters were treated in the show. And this I found really interesting. There was an expectation, you know, Game of Thrones has actually been spoken about by many as being a sort of feminist type of show, a very, lots of very strong leading female characters, and women who sort of buck trends in many ways. And there was this strange, for me, perspective of this clash between the perception of a desire for a depiction of a world in which these female characters came out on top, and the realities of the show itself, in which these female characters often don't come out on top of things. And so in particular, you know, in the end, Daenerys Targaryen, there was a lot of critiques of the shift in her character trajectory, in which she ended up sort of going mad, is sort of what in the second last episode, and destroying King's Landing, the main capital city, with her dragon. And there were a lot of critiques that you know, that this was not realistic to her character development, which I don't agree with, but also that it made the show sort of become less feminist in its approach, because the depiction of a mad woman was not something that was very progressive in this way, and there was a lot of anger at how she was depicted throughout the show. And I think that those two criticisms at the end I found really interesting, because it sort of had this demand of a requirement that the show do what the fans wanted, and that it has a responsibility to the fans, but also that it has a responsibility to depict certain views of the world, and that those certain views should be sort of progressive in many ways. And I think that this is something that I see running through a lot of threads of critiques of pop culture, and that was why I was really interested in it, because I find that really frustrating, because I think that the demand to have a depiction of a world that is somehow inherently progressive doesn't meet the reality of what the world is and what pop culture can do in highlighting, in creating good stories, actually, and just creating good stories.
Sure. I mean, I would agree with that final point, but I think my take on the final season of Game of Thrones was very, very different. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen some of the critiques. I've certainly seen some of the critiques you're talking about other things, but I haven't seen so much of it around Game of Thrones. I didn't like the final season. My relationship to the show, I read the books years and years and years ago before the show started, and then watched the show and dropped off after about season 4. I was just struggling a bit with the violence of it, and I think particularly the sexual violence, which is something I'd like to come back to.
Yeah, sure. I think that's important.
Not so much, not necessarily just the depictions of it in the show, but the fact that I couldn't bring myself to watch it, because it can be quite gratuitous at times. For me, the final season didn't work, and I've read a really great, the only kind of take I've read on it, which I thought really reflected my feelings, was in Scientific American, really, with the stupid headline, "The Real Reasons Fans Hate the Last Season of Game of Thrones,"
which
is a terrible season. But it I think really captured a terrible headline, rather, but I think really captured what I think. And the article basically argues that what had made the show really compelling up until season 6, I guess, there are a bunch of seasons in the middle that I still haven't actually watched, but...
Oh, that's interesting.
The consensus, yeah, but I sort of know, I kept vaguely up to date with what was going on, so I didn't feel like I'd been missing anything. But people seem to say that season 7 is where it really became a different show. The article argues that the reason the early seasons had been so compelling, and this reflects why I enjoyed the book so much, is that it's a rare story that is really invested in institutional and structural storytelling. So at its heart, I think Game of Thrones is a story about the kind of relentless violence of institutions,
yeah,
and
absolutely,
the ways that things like war and violence are the products of these big structural institutional forces that grind everyone beneath them, and in the face of which individuals can only... You know, their choices are very constrained. It's not that individuals don't matter, but that you're kind of set up against these massive institutional forces. Like something like all of the big plot points in the books and the show, you can say, it's like this big kind of Rube Goldberg machine. Like each thing happens because the thing before it happened.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
The Red Wedding happened because, you know, the Freys had felt like the Starks had been looking down on them for generations, and because Rob didn't go through with a promise to marry someone, and he promised to marry someone because they needed to get across a bridge at a certain time, and they needed to get across a bridge at a certain time because they were fighting a war, and the war started because of Ned Stark getting killed. And
you can
Ned Stark
go back
getting
to
killed.
Episode one and say, you know, Ned Stark, don't go south to King's Landing and none of this will happen.
For sure, but even further back and say, you know, like there's no point that you can go far enough back and say that this is the starting point because ultimately it's all part of the same system and structure. And I think that that's kind of what makes the show really interesting. What this article argues, and I'll link to it in the show notes, is that when the show moved away from the source material of the books, it seemed like the showrunners fell back on the way that Hollywood usually knows how to do storytelling, which isn't sociological as it had been in the early stages of the show and in the books. It became individual and psychological, which is a really, which is the kind of standard mode for storytelling in Hollywood, and is why we saw a shift from, I guess the kind of intricacies of how each event developed out of each other event, and a shift towards a focus on the kind of arcs of individual characters in the show. And the author argues that even though a lot of the plot points in the final couple of seasons, it's highly likely that they are what George R. R. Martin, the author of the books, intends to happen.
Well, that's been said. He told them what was going to happen at the
end. Yes. Because the focus of the storytelling shifted, the justifications for getting to those story beats weren't clear and didn't quite make sense. And so I feel like something like Dany burning down King's Landing is a good example where on paper it works. Like on paper, I get why she would do it and I see how the show had been trying to build to that, but it just didn't sell it because it had moved away from this, as this article argues, this kind of structural mode of storytelling. So they weren't, it just didn't justify these kind of big events in structural and institutional terms as it had previously. It all came down to individual decisions made by particular characters at certain moments. I think the same is true of John deciding to kill her, for example. Like, there's an inevitability to all of the big moments of the show early on, and these just felt like individual characters making individual decisions in the moment.
I have to think about that a little bit more, but I'm not quite sure I agree with it in all instances. I think there was an inevitability to Dany burning down King's Landing. I think that what was interesting to me was the explanation of it at the end, that of this sort of measure of this sort of, the showrunner said that she sort of made this snap decision when it went on Drogon. And I didn't buy that. That I certainly didn't buy. I feel like it was a calculated, it would have been more of a sale to say it was a calculated decision, a decision she felt she had to make because that was the only way that she could win.
But again, it's like I get that that's in theory how it could have played out, and in the books I can imagine it playing out that way. But I think on screen that's not what we saw. It looked like a snap judgment.
Yeah, and that is a critique I certainly have, because I think that the decision makes sense. You know, the action makes sense, and I was willing to sort of sacrifice that snap decision approach to because I think that the action makes sense. I don't agree with I didn't like the way that they explained the decision or the way that they depicted it.
But to me, the show early on is all about the explanation. Like, it's all in the justification.
Yeah. But I think what I've also seen is, what I've seen, that the critiques that I've found most interesting and the ones that I've really disagreed with were people who couldn't understand Dany ever doing that ever. And actually there was a video I watched the senator from the United States, Kirsten Gillibrand. You know, sometimes they have these videos of people, she's a presidential candidate, and they have these videos of people talking about things that, you know, behind the scenes, you know, having a discussion about a random thing, and she was discussing Game of Thrones. And she was like, I can't believe that Dany would ever do that. Throughout her entire career, she's been really about giving people from a lower standing a voice and having a more representative form of democracy, of governance, which she literally said. And, you know, she would never do that to destroy these people. And I'm like, well, have you ever watched this show? Like, have you ever seen, you know, Dany's entire thing is a belief in a God-given right to rule the Iron Throne. She is an invader, with an army that comes from a different land. You know, she's not some sort of, you know, she was never a somebody who was there to fully speak for the little guy. Yes, she certainly was a did that in Essos, you know, when she would free the slaves. But, you know, she was still there was deliberate depictions of her as being kind of a white savior in those approaches.
Totally. I mean, I think that her justification for example, freeing slaves was less about her investment in emancipation than it was about her investment in the idea of herself as a savior.
Yes, yes. And then also this, you know, and also the capacity to build an army with those slaves, you know, that I think that's an important factor.
Yes, that too. Yeah.
And I think that this is where I found it super interesting in some of these critiques and this demand to sort of, you know, I think that there was people didn't like that character in particular sort of being the bad person. They wanted to have an investment in her being being a savior of some form. And I think that is where I found myself being like, well, you know, this desire to see a world that is depicted in a particular sort of way, and a world that is like a democratic republic in the end that is led by Danny, who has saved everybody and emancipated everybody. You know, it was never going to happen in the show, but it's kind of been the demands that I've seen so many people sort of get really upset about, and I find that. That sort of critique really interesting and frustrating, because it doesn't, you know, sometimes having a show can still be feminist while female characters don't get treated well, or a show can still be feminist with a female character not ending up on the top. It can, as you know, I think that the issue is whether you fall back into sort of sexist stereotypes of that show, or that, you know, that women do these things because they're women. And I don't feel like the show fell into that trap, at least from my perspective.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yeah, again, I agree, but I can forgive a lot of those sorts of reactions, at least in the case of the final season of Game of Thrones, I think in part because the storytelling, as I said, took such a radical left turn in style rather than in content. But I certainly agree with you in the case of lots of other things. I mean, yeah, it's tricky, though. Like, I think about a show like The Handmaid's Tale, for example, yep, which has been a really big show over the past couple of years, which is another show that I got through about half a season of, and I'm a big Margaret Atwood fan and really, really like the book. But I just found the show too violent, too bleak, and it's not like I need a utopia in all of my TV shows, but I also think that sometimes, and this is, I guess, almost the reverse of what you're saying, sometimes pop culture tries to defend itself, specific instances of pop culture try to defend themselves as critiques of sexism or racism or violence or whatever. But I think it's very easy for them, in those instances to just be that thing. Like, I watch Game of Thrones as well. Like, I see, like, the sexual violence in Game of Thrones and go, is this a critique of how structures cause sexual violence, or is it just showing me sexual violence? Like, I don't have an answer to that, but I think I'm often just viscerally discomforted by seeing really intense violence on screen. And sometimes I can see it being justified. Like, if I think that it's really saying something really interesting or is, I don't know, good for some other reason. Like, it might just be really beautifully shot, or it might be really fun or something like that. I mean, it's a kind of a weird word you choose in this context. But
like, you know, you can think about something like Kill Bill as a version of almost fun violence in a way.
It's totally, very,
it's
yeah, very exactly.
It's dramatic and it's over the top and it's
but it's...
It's designed to be ridiculous.
Totally. That's a really great example, actually. And I love Tarantino films for that reason. I do find them very fun. But watching, like, I had this problem with Mad Men in the early seasons, although I think it became a much better show as it went along. I really struggled to watch it because I was watching it and I'm just like, this just feels like sexism and homophobia. It doesn't feel like critiques of sexism and homophobia. And I think you can fall really on either side of that in any given instance. But for me, at least, I think I can be quite sensitive to some of that stuff sometimes, particularly on screen. It doesn't bother me so much in books, which is why the Game of Thrones books didn't faze me as much. And The Handmaid's Tale, the book, didn't faze me as much. But when you're translating something onto screen in particular, I think, you know, as a visual medium, it's inherently more explicit. And so you have to sort of do subtlety in other ways.
It's but, interesting yeah. because you've pointed at, you know, Game of Thrones, Handmaid's Tale, and Mad Men are all three shows that I really enjoy. Or enjoy is, you know, I'm not sure if I enjoy Handmaid's Tale, but I do find I get something out of it. You know, I mean, it's quite like it makes me quite tense. But I don't know, and I'm not critiquing your approach to this, and I guess I'm wondering about this, but I have a very different relationship to violence on screen, Game of Thrones is very brutal, but I've never once sat and felt that it was too much for me. And maybe I'm just desensitized to violence on screen. I don't know, but I never felt that it was like that. It was so much that I had to turn away. I've had to turn away because I was like tense about what was going to happen. But I've never felt it was too brutal in that kind of way.
Sure. And I feel like that's, you know, that's person to person.
Yeah. And that's person to person. But I think there's an interesting question about, okay, so in that instance where something like me, and I've sort of listened to the critiques about the sexual violence in particular, but the violence on Game of Thrones in general, and you could say the same thing about Handmaid's Tale is another really good example of a show that is very brutal and depicts, you know, very openly depicts rape and things like that in a really awful way. And for me, I have always felt that sometimes accurate depictions of the awful stuff that happens is an important thing for pop culture to be doing. And I don't know what the line is between that and gratuitous depictions of these sorts of things. And I was thinking about what you're saying about, you know, is this a critique of sexism and homophobia, or is it like, you know, just being sexism and homophobia? And
I don't think there's a clear answer to that.
Yeah. No. And sometimes I wonder, do shows need to actually be engaged in critique? Or could they just be depicting a thing, a story that happens in the world, and that we take that story and create our own critique based off it, right? And so what is the responsibility for them to... What is the responsibility of pop culture to inscribe a message into what they're doing compared to telling a story about something that is happening? Now, a lot of people want to do both of those things, but if people don't want to do those things, do they have to? Do we really need to have that sort of that political message that comes through, or the moral message that comes through? Does there need to be a moral to the story, or could they just be a story?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question. I think responsibility is one way to think about it. I think just taste is another. Like I don't for a lot of these instances, I'm fine just saying, look, this isn't for me. These are the political reasons why it's not for me, but I'm not objecting to its existence. I think particularly in the case of a show like The Handmaid's Tale, I probably do have a bit more of an issue with it because it's a show that is framing itself explicitly as a feminist show.
That's
how people talk about it. And that that's has, how and the creators talk about it.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think Game of Thrones was ever doing that from my reading.
No, I don't think Game of Thrones is pretending to be that. So I think that's part of it. I also am a little... Yeah, again, this is something I could go either way on, but I guess I'm a little uncomfortable about talking about whether these sorts of things are accurate depictions of things that happen in the world. And not just because they're fantasy shows, as these are, but because it's TV. Like, it's never going to be... Like, even if it was a documentary, there is still a kind of spectacular element, as in...
Yeah, of course.
It is spectacle to any sort of media that we consume. That means that, you know, no media has complete verisimilitude with the real world. Like, you're making choices, you're making directorial, authorial choices about how you depict something. And so I've never been entirely convinced, I think, by that argument, although I do consider it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I guess maybe to nuance my point a little, I guess it goes down to the question, of course, you know, people are making those directorial decisions. Writers are making decisions about what they want to do. And I guess the question I ask is people would have different purposes for the different stories that they want to tell. And I think that I see a trend of, particularly when it comes to things like sexism and homophobia and racism in storytelling, I see a trend of a critique that demands that everything be a critique in some ways, that it be a version of The Handmaid's Tale, or what The Handmaid's Tale is trying to tell us it is, a reflection on our society, holding a mirror up to our society and demanding that we... And critiquing our society and looking at where it could go and all these sorts of things. And I think that I think that there are other reasons to be telling stories beyond that demand for critique. And I feel like...
Totally. Fucking often, entertainment.
Yeah, entertainment or, you know, or a desire, even if it's not, you know, realistic that it can happen, of a desire to just... to tell a story that is as realistic as possible. Or, I mean, Game of Thrones, of course, is not realistic. And, you know, Handmaid's Tale is, you know, has some realism elements to it, but is not, you know, representative of a society that currently exists. You know, there is no Gilead. But I think that, you know, sometimes it can just be, you know, telling a fantasy story is the purpose in and of itself. Where we continuously demand that there is a political critique of some form that exists in the story, a critique of sexism, a critique of homophobia, then I'm like, well, do we actually need to have that? Or could it just be a story that is being told?
And
can we just embrace the story of it? You know, I think this
and
is
I
one
take,
of...
I take that point. I feel like it is similar to the argument of, you know, like seeing really horrific violence on the news, for example, or seeing like footage from war zones or something. Like, I think that there is value to, even if it is really shocking and horrible, there is value to knowing that that is happening in the world and being forced to confront it. But even in those cases, I don't have a really strong view one way or the other, because while I agree with those sorts of critiques, I also wonder what is served from a political purpose by being forced to confront that stuff. I'm very critical, I guess, of the extent to which empathy arising from those exposure to that sort of stuff is productive, what its kind of outcomes can be. And again, like, totally not that productivity needs to be, political productivity needs to be a requirement of any sort of media, but... Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's just a counterbalance to the argument that it's important for us to see that stuff.
Yeah, and I think at the same time, while I'm making my argument, I think I have spoken to multiple people who, you know, I love Game of Thrones. You know, I've never actually read the books, but I'm not a reader of fantasy books very much, but I am deeply considering like starting to read the books because I'm interested in the intricacies of it.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah.
And, but I have spoken to multiple people who said, I can't deal with the violence on that show. And I totally understand it. I don't feel like there's a demand. The interesting thing I think has been people who continue to insist on watching the show and then can't, and then are like, you know, but the violence is too much. And I was like, well, that is the show. You know,
sure,
that,
yeah.
you know, if you don't like the violence, don't watch the show. No one is forcing you to watch the show.
Yeah, totally.
You
know, and that's fair, yeah.
And I think that is where I find it really interesting of people who are like, you know, and there are plenty of people I know who don't watch the show because they don't like the violence. And I'm like, of course, I totally understand that. I don't, you know, I was talking to some friends recently about horror movies and I'm like sort of tempted by horror movies, but I sometimes don't like the feeling of them. And they're like, well, you know, if you don't enjoy them, don't enjoy them. You don't, no one's forcing you to watch this pop culture, you know, these things. And there are plenty of people out there who have totally missed the Game of Thrones, you know, thing. And, you know, they're fine. They're not, you know, it's not like this is a major issue.
No, these people are socially ostracized. They have nothing to talk about in most conversations.
At least in the last week or two, they certainly probably have struggled. But like, it's that demand that every show meet this particular sort of frame of this particular sort of political critique that I find troubling, and that's one of the things I found frustrating about the critiques of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and I think we see that a lot in particularly. I mean, any sort of pop culture that has a really intense fandom around it. You see it in video games a lot. For example, I'm a big video game player. And games like Overwatch, which is a very popular first-person shooter that's been big over the past couple of years. And it's kind of got a reputation for having quite a diverse cast of characters that you can choose to play. But it's also led to pretty intense demands from sections of the fan base for it to be more diverse in particular ways, or anger that that Blizzard, the company that makes it, are not doing XYZ things. And yeah, I have really mixed feelings about it because part of me is like, this is a company, like, why are you investing so much into what this company, whether this company is like doing good politics, what does that even mean? But it's also a huge part of a lot of people's lives. And I mean, I can't directly relate to that impulse, but I think I kind of understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, and I think we've certainly seen that with Game of Thrones. One of the things I found interesting at the end was seeing people tweet things like, well, that was 8 years of my life wasted, or I invested so much in this and I got so little reward for it. This sort of investment that people put into these franchises. And I think, you know, something like Game of Thrones is such a great example of this because people did invest so much into it. And
totally. And the show, and it's important to acknowledge that the internet is structured and designed and incentivized in ways to get us really invested in these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, it's a bit, yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm now being pushed in kind of a different direction, but I think it's kind of a bit rich for this massive machine that is all about encouraging really rabid fandoms to then go, oh, I take no responsibility for what I've created. Yeah, I don't know.
But I'm not sure anybody is saying they take no responsibility for what they've created, though. I think that the problem with this, with a show like this, is that there was never going to be a way that this would have appeased made everybody happy. You know, a friend of mine who I watch it with was like, well, this is what fan fiction is for, really. This is, you know, this is why fan fiction is so great, because there is a space out there that people can do this investment of their own and can create alternative storylines and can do it. You know, here is one version of this story that has been told. If you wanted to do a different one, go and write fan fiction, and that is a great way to sort of express those feelings. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you would like to support the podcast, maybe consider subscribing to our Patreon. You can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/queerspodcast. It's a really great way to help us continue making the podcast. And there's also a range of new and exciting and different content available if you subscribe. Otherwise, if you'd like to get in touch or make a comment, you can do so through various ways on the internet.
You can email us. We get lots of fantastic email at queerspodcast@gmail.com. We are at queerspodcast on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And we also get lots of great comments and feedback on there. We have personal social media. Simon is at Simon Copland Writer on Facebook. He's at Simon Copland on Twitter. And I'm at Ben C. Riley on Twitter.
You can also find the podcast on our website, queerspodcast.com. And please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. And if you do, please leave us a review and rating. It really helps us with the rankings and therefore helps other people find us.
You can subscribe also on wherever else you get podcasts. We're on Spotify now. We're on all the different platforms. So check us out. Thank you to our podcast network, Lit Media. They're really fantastic and have been really great to us. Go and check out their other shows. They have a lot of good stuff and are doing really cool stuff if you're keen to hear Australian queer podcast content. finally tell a friend. It's really the best way we have to get new listeners for the podcast. We hear about lots of people recommending it to other people they know. So if you would like to do that, that would be lovely.
Thanks everyone for listening.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.